A Month of Jazz at the Music Gallery. On Friday and Saturday, October 26th and 27th at 8 p.m., Specific Dangers presents Lunar Adventures. Vancouver's Lunar Adventures has established a reputation as one of the hottest jazz acts on the West Coast. The music of this quartet reflects a variety of sources and influences, their sounds encompassing jazz, harmonic funk, Celtic, and other world musics. On Friday, Lunar Adventures will be joined by the duo of Lyle Ellis and Paul Cram. Downbeat magazine said Lyle Ellis can get near miraculous sounds from his bow. Paul Cram, Juno nominee, has long been a force in Canadian jazz. On Saturday, Lyle Ellis is joined by pianist Paul Plimley. This duo were among the highlights of last year's Victoriaville Festival. That's Lunar Adventures with Lyle Ellis, Paul Cram, Paul Plimley on Friday and Saturday, October 26th and 27th at the Music Gallery, 1087 Queen Street West at Dovercourt.
Saturday, September the 29th, the headline reads, Peterson elected Bob Rae. And the subtitle is, a cellular phone call to Premier's bus prompted the decision that sank the campaign that shouldn't have been. It's a great article by Thomas Walcom. And he goes on to cite the three mistakes that led to the downfall of David Peterson. Here's how he describes the first one. This is how he begins the article. It was 4 weeks into the provincial election campaign and Premier David Peterson was speeding towards Cornwall. Peterson had a big decision to make. As it turned out, it would be the decision on which his campaign re-election hinged. Should he announce a cut in the provincial sales tax? The cut had been strongly urged by the Liberal Strategy Committee, the group of backroomers who were masterminding Peterson's campaign. But Treasurer Bob Nixon had been reluctant, and some aides argued that a tax cut now could backfire, that it would be seen as an attempt to bribe voters with their own money. So as Peterson rumbled along in his campaign bus, he pondered, until a call came in on the cellular phone. It was from Nixon. Do it, he told Peterson. Peterson did it, and the campaign was lost. That was August 22nd. That's what Mr. Walcom has decided was what brought Peterson down, and that was the timing. That was August 22nd. Praise Premier Bob.
Laughing like a hyena. You should sue for slander. So anyway, that was a good article. I happened to meet Robert Hoff on the weekend by chance. He thinks you're brilliant, but, well, you know, writers. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hi, Bob. This is Scott. I just got back into town Monday night at 9:30. I was in Montreal climbing a crane for Greenpeace. I got popped by the police. I missed a show, but someone taped Sherman Skolnick in the first half hour of the Exus channeling. I found it very rewarding. Thank you very much, Bob. I'll talk to you soon, maybe next show, unless you want to give me a call.
The Toronto Star's Saturday magazine has on its cover The Word on the Street, the first annual Toronto book and magazine fair. And as usual, Philip Marchand, under the heading of books, has an article there. And Philip, the figure, has returned to identify his ground. So he returns to the subject of Marshall McLuhan. And the article is one single page, with about a third of the page occupied by a photo of Marshall, gesturing with his hand, some sort of retrieval of tactility. Anyway, so he's gesturing away with his hand there, and the caption, which has probably been put in by the photo editor, it says, Marshall McLuhan, the man with the message. Well, at least they didn't say the medium is the message, they just show a picture of the medium. So, the man with the message. Anyway, Marshall goes through this fairly long-winded explanation there about the different types of media that are available to us today and how they affect us differently. And then he really gets to the substance of the matter in the very last paragraph, and here's what he says. Marshall himself was never entirely enamored of the new electronic media environment. His main point was that we needed a balance in our media diet, a heavy intake of print to counteract our absorption of television. We could really, if we wanted, have the best of both worlds. We could have the immediacy and involvement of the broadcast media with the detachment and the analytical stance fostered by print media. But large numbers of the young in particular are in danger of being swamped by television, which is extremely seductive. Not that Bob isn't seductive, of course, but I don't know what Philip's trying to get at here. It could be taken two ways. Here he's talking about a need. He's trying to retrieve an idea of Marshall's that we need a balance in our media diet. He's not talking about a media fast. He's not, I don't know if he's really talking about the kind of media ecology that's on your show. So the question is has Philip Marchand not been tuning into the program, not gotten onto the agenda, or is he listening to the Church of the Subgenius and putting out a contrary point of view? I think we need an explanation from Mr. Marchand.
Newsflash from the Hype Newsroom, Metropolis folds. That's right, Hype Magazine, now Magazine's official competition. Advertising agents defected. Mixed corporate media. Woo!
Hey, I just thought, I don't know why I'm sharing this with you, but I just thought the funny thing is that this young lady takes her little baby to, like, the store, and the guy stands at the counter, and she gets cigarettes, and then he reaches over on the other side and gets pacifiers, and the baby takes the pacifier, and she takes a cigarette, and they both put them in their mouths and suck and get pacified.
Bob, it's Eric. I am very stumped here, and I can't find anybody else who can help me on this. I'm looking for a definition of RAMHSA. Give me a call tomorrow at work. This is driving me crazy. My manager is driving me crazy on this one.
Hey, Bobby. A couple of quick funny things. Just going through the secret diary of Laura Palmer, and it's written by Jennifer Lynch. I think there's a family relation there, a daughter or something. Well, it looks like Bob's the main character in this. If you saw the last Twin Peaks, then you'll know that we've discovered Bob is actually the Exist. And in here, he's Laura's midnight rapist. He really scares her a lot and lives inside her head. So maybe you should just cut that out, eh, Bob? And she says also about Bob, his name is a warning in itself. Beware of Bob, B-O-B. And speaking of beware, we can go right over to the new eye-opener, Ryerson's Weekly. And we got two articles, one on page three, hate mongers out front of Jorgensen Hall. And then we go to the editorial, and it's LaRouche La Quack. So they got their anti-LaRouche propaganda out in full force ever since you mentioned it on the last show. And they had to respond pretty quickly. Bye, Bob.
Messages for Bob Marshall. My name is David Oansi. I'm from Brave New Wave, CBC in Montreal. I was trying to get the number for Reverend Ivan Stang, and I was given your number by Mike Dyer. If you could please call me back, that would be terrific. Area code is 514-597-4490. I'll be here until 9 o'clock tonight, and if not, I'll be in tomorrow from 1 to 9. Time presently is 5:30. Thank you very much.
Wow. So much to digest. So little time to do it. Bob, welcome. Welcome, listeners, to the Church of the Subgenius. It's another Wednesday night. Good to have you here.
Well, it always gets exciting and escalated in October, the 10th month.
Mm-hmm.
What's tonight, the 10th? 10-10.
Yes.
Secret Council 10 night, I guess.
Can I point out right at the very beginning of tonight's show that you're on tonight, as always, as per our schedule, but you will be in next week as well, because next week, as many of our listeners know, is fundraising, right in the middle of fundraising. Next week is our show, and I think it's important that you come down during that fundraising segment. And I'd like to put an open invitation out to all our listeners and to the people who call. You are more than welcome to come down and join. And it's a lot of fun, isn't it, Bob?
Certainly is, and of course I'll be making predictions as it has been requested.
Yeah,
with the help of the exes.
Yeah, and with the help of your pledges as well.
Yes, and like last year, we raised a lot of money, and I think we helped put CKLR over the top, and I expect the church members to do it again this year. We're going for a big chunk this time.
We're counting on them.
So, everybody, did you say everybody can come down?
Yeah, anyone who can come down or who wants to, you're more than welcome. If you have any questions about how to get here, if you haven't been here before, we can give you directions.
Come on down and fire walk with Bob.
Yeah, that's a special occasion. Next week, fundraising. So that's all I wanted to say.
Okay, the phone numbers are 595-1655 or 1478 or 1479.
Right.
If you want to get in on the act right away, go discurrent with Bob.
And I know we have new listeners as well.
We do?
I know we do.
Oh, okay.
I just feel it.
All right. Now, the thing is, there was so much material in those messages that I took notes for the first time, to remind me.
Yeah.
Is that Kent in the background?
I think it's cleaner.
Yeah. Okay. I know that the August 22nd show was a very profound, moving, intense, and well manipulated show by yourself, and I think we really shook up the area, and I think George is wise to note the article in the paper noticing the effect of August 22nd on Peterson. That's an important point. I like the way the next caller, Ed, pointed out that he talked to Robert Hoffa, who wrote the article on Mike and I and Connie in this magazine. It's on the stands now. He says, Robert thinks I'm brilliant, but... And then Mike goes, Ed goes, you know writers. What do you think it means by that, Mike? They've got to be, what? They can't merge, right? They got to keep detached.
Show their objectivity.
Yeah, their detachment. So he ain't going to get involved in the emotion of multitude. Yeah. So it's right there, and I think that's what Edward meant.
In fact, if we could just clarify, it was in fact Robert who laughed like a hyena that night. I remember that night vividly. He was slapping his knee and laughing like a hyena, and he just passed that action on to you. So let's clarify that right now.
He was right. He mixed the truth there. He was right that right after the show I went running into you and said, great show, Mike. You know, fine work. And he had me slapping my knee. Well, you're right. It was Robert who was slapping his knee. I was laughing all the way through the show. It's just that Mike is a filter and filters that out. You think the Bob image on Twin Peaks is dangerous? Look at me laughing in this studio all through the two-hour show. One other point about Hoff. I called him up and congratulated him on the article. Excellent article. I said it was riddled with errors, but since he was dealing with an awesome topic, his probe, his distillation was profound and well done.
Mm-hmm.
So kudos to Robert Hoff.
And the continuing denial of Adam Egoyan. His...
It was over. Yeah. I got him on tape. We'll play it some night. Me demanding Adam Egoyan to eat a plum in the kitchen. He wouldn't eat my plum. Then Scott, he liked the Axis press conference, and he wants to get a tape that he mentioned. I think he wanted to know if he could get a tape. Well, Kent will be looking after that, it seems. So call Kent later, Scott, if you want to get a copy of the press conference. Also, we'll be off. Maybe we'll offer it as a prize next week. That's a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
I am going to offer Kent's offering it as a prize, and so is Wayne Morris on International Connection. So you can see how valuable that press conference was. Many programmers offering it as a prize. Again, paid for by Bob, $500, and, there it is, helping the station get by with their prizes. Let's see, Jerry, Hype Magazine, adds, he said the advertising agent, the advertising executive or the person who gets the ads at Metropolis Magazine. Good news there. She happened to be dating Dante, the publisher of, just a minute, Kent there. Kent's just coming in here. Anyways, Dante, the publisher of, we on, Mike? Yeah, we're on. Dante, the publisher of
it likes me just a little too much.
Yeah, the mic, Ken's gravity is attracting the microphone. Hold it there. It looks like we can't get this Dante fact out. Dante, the publisher of Hype, was dating the advertising businesswoman, person who got the clients for Metropolis. I guess she was laid off when Metropolis went down, so Hype got her. So me being the spiritual advisor of that magazine, it looks like the slack is pouring in. They may outdo now with their fine example of graphic psychology, which Mike doesn't appreciate. And then what else? I like Jerry's use of the mixed corporate media phrase. Very good. Mixing corporate media. Hype is attempting to put on a corporate audience, and they hijack some people from the other corporate medium, Metropolis. Dave pointing out about the people, the mother and the baby sucking on things, right? That's gravity. Earth sucks, right? There it is. It's a heavy psychological collective unconscious conditioning, this sucking apparatus, and it seems that humans like to suck from birth, from womb to tomb, right? Womb to tomb. You see, Eric left a message. He's getting hassled by his manager. Came to Bob. Bob explained it. And I was listening to the archives, and we actually talked about Ramtha last show, and Eric needed to know what Ramtha was. The drink sounds, nice interval. Did you get those drink sounds, like ice in a glass? That was sort of maybe someone just sitting back, having some liquid frop and feeling slack, and said, I got to tell Bob this. So they call up and shake the glass in the tape recorder. We're going to get into Twin Peaks tonight. That's very important. The Results are in. It's obviously about Mike and Bob. And if you've seen the last two shows, the premiere of the second series and last Saturday's show, you know that I think we can analyze now why the women for this church in Toronto are absent. Where are the women?
I think we've got
the answer now with Laura's diary, but I'll get into that a little later. Thanks to Jim for the quotes from Twin Peaks, Play with Bob, Play with Fire, and the second quote from the third show of the first series, where in the dream of Cooper, the man, the wizard, Mike, is talking like the interval man, talking about the magician yearning for being between two worlds, right?
There's a different tone to the new series, isn't there?
It's
a different series.
Yeah, Jerry told me the ratings went way down.
Oh, I can believe it.
Yeah, because it's getting serious, because that's what we're going to talk about. So last item was from Dave Oancia, O-A-N-C-I-A. He's like, he owns the CIA. He's from Montreal. He has the gall to call Mike and ask for Stang's phone number. The American Church. This is a Canadian organization, the CBC, and they're looking for the American stalwart. So I thank Mike for telling me about this. I called the guy. He got a call from Bob Dobbs. He couldn't believe it. And I told him he ain't going to get Stang's phone number until he reviews the material that's going on here in Toronto. All right? So I sent him the stuff. He's going to get back to me. He isn't going to fool me. He's going to say, yeah, this is very good stuff, Mr. Dobbs. Certainly we'll use it in the program. Just give us Stang's number. We ain't going to ever give him Stang's number. Okay? So that just shows you where the CBC's at, eh? What's the show called? Beneath the Waves or something?
Brave New Waves.
Brave New Waves? Yeah, sure. They got to read a little Stephen Hawking and find out about the wavicle. You know, half wave, half particle. That's what we are here, right? Half ego, half collective merging. I was once accused by Dave of Baldwin Foods of having a big ego. Well, that's the particle level of matter. And then there's the wavicle, or the wave part of matter. And what's that? That's the electric water we're swimming in. And we can't tell who's who. You can't tell whether Mike or Bob is running the show, or even if it's on tape.
We have to get the archives and check.
Okay, could you just stop the undertow for a second? Oh, let's listen to it.
Remember, we'd have to get the archives and check this out. Use it. We'd have to get the archives to check this out.
Four in this country, right?
No, sir.
We have.
Yes, sir. And
do you know how many time zones they have?
Yes, sir. Four. No, sir. I never really studied that out.
Use it. We'd have to get the archives to check this out. Use it. Something about time zones in the Soviet Union in your, you know, scattered pre-Bob realization state of mind before Czechoslovakia happened.
Right.
Yeah, when you're confused, you know, under the influence
of
Stang's...
There's only eight now.
Under the influence of Stang's church. Under the influence of Stang's church. Under the influence of Stang's church. Under the influence of Stang's church.
That's what we can do. We can go anywhere because we live here. We can go anywhere else.
But not only the right of free travel, I'm saying the 11.
Under the influence of Stang's church. 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 And I think I wanted to remind you that I checked it out, and I think there were 11.
Yeah, I can believe that. I'm a firm believer.
Mike, where is this from? This is awesome. Again, your technical manipulation is manipian-like.
I'd like to take credit for it, but it's from George.
Oh, it's a local job.
Another George tape.
George in Toronto.
Yeah.
The Church of George. Now, did he get it from someone else? He might have got it from someone else.
This is from our archives.
Well, where did he get... he did this last year. He did it for the fundraising last year. He put together a tape. So this is him taking some stuff from a subgenius Dallas tape, you know, a couple of years ago. The time zone thing, I remember that, and putting it up with Bob. Nice editing. And again, you timed it right in. Did you know this was about Stang? We just talked about CBC and Stang, and you put this in. This is the kind of skill that you psychically come up with.
Just let it happen, Bob.
Yeah.
Don't question.
Okay, can we have some silence for a second? Are you going to, like, stop the tape, or do you let it run as it's silently under tow? Okay, Mike doesn't want it. We can't probe too much into that sacred territory across the window here where Mike is... creating that magic, firewalking. All right. How are we going to do this? Okay. You just look at the notes here. Mike, I think to begin discussing Twin Peaks, we're not going to take calls for another 5 or 10 minutes, okay? Because this is important to get out. Because we got to explain why the Twin Peaks has taken a different atmosphere, a different mood, a different direction. I think the first show pointed out the significance of Bob and proved that Blue Velvet was about, and a letter to Bob Marshall. And Twin Peaks is a letter, message, warning to Mike and Bob, with Bob as the hidden ground. Kent's leaving.
I'm just going to smoke some prop.
Oh, okay. He'll need this for the next half hour of the show. It's going to get intense. Okay, to prove that Dale Cooper is Bob Marshall from Blue Velvet. If you noticed, several shows ago, I don't know when it was, it might have been before the second series started, he pointed out that he didn't like birds. You remember him saying that? Just a quick statement. Some birds came up and he says, I don't like birds. That's Agent Cooper.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you go back to Blue Velvet, the last scene is the young Agent Cooper in Lumbertown, right? Or Lumberton, up in the Pacific Northwest. He is looking at what, Mike? You remember the last image of Blue Velvet? You don't.
Mm-hmm.
He's looking at a bird eat a worm. All right? And in that pre-slack state he had, a latent subgenius that he was, he is sitting there after the trauma of the events of the movie with his suburban home, his girlfriend, and looking out the window. And in that suggestible state, it's mirrored by the bird consuming the worm. Now, who the worm is more elaborated in Twin Peaks, right? All right, now that's why at the beginning of Twin Peaks, the opening repeated images of every show is what?
See that bird?
And then the factory.
Yeah.
You see the old nature and the new industrial nature juxtaposed. Now, Agent Cooper is an interesting interval between the two. See, Agent Cooper is not Bob. Twin Peaks, the whole piece, the whole epic, is a message to Bob. But Cooper plays the role of Bob Marshall, you know, grown up. And he's there. If you saw the Saturday Night Live satire on Twin Peaks, you see that, Mike?
Yep.
You notice they portrayed Cooper as obsessive and a technological fetish,
mm-hmm.
fetishist, in the sense that he was into the chemical apparatus and content of the bed sheets and the various developments like room service, which was referred to in the real Twin Peaks. Right? So you have the technological cyberpunk Bob Marshall angle in Cooper, right? But that's what he is. Now, the extreme version of that is, of course, the John Jones lookalike, Albert Rosenfeld or Rosenflower. Andy keeps mixing me up. I can't remember what his name. You know, notice how Andy changes his names? His name, Albert, is the extreme cyberpunk, right? Now, at the other end, you have Cooper, torn in between. He's leaning also, he's discovering human scale in old nature terms here. He's impressed with the Douglas fir, the ducks, the community, and the natural setting of Twin Peaks. So, and this is idealized by Tibet, and I'm going to move that to another level. Anyways, the point is that Cooper, the cyberpunk, is torn between the attraction of nature in Twin Peaks and his own technological environment that he represents in the FBI, right? So there he is in the interval. Then we move, so that proves that Cooper comes out of Blue Velvet, right? With the bird thing. The next point is, what is the meaning of the Twin Peaks symbols? There's the bird, and there's a factory, and in the second series he's added a new symbol. Did you notice it?
Yeah, it is longer.
Third image.
Is it the water? No.
No, it's a huge log.
No, I don't remember that.
Yeah, in the opening sequence, mm-hmm. you get the bird, the factory. What's the water first? The water comes after, right? Yeah, the bird, the factory, and then you have this huge log. And log, well, there's more to that, an obvious reference to the log lady. And now a new symbol is the owl, superimposed on the evil Bob. Eva Bob's face in the next dream at Cooper Head. And the owl is very important. If you read Laura Palmer's diary, there's much reference to the owls. And, of course, the aspect of Bob Marshall, Agent Cooper, getting in touch with the aliens is obvious now with the giant showing up occasionally. And this is the Exus. This is the Bob Dobbs theme, the role of Bob Dobbs, which Bob Marshall is, what, evolving to, becoming Bob Dobbs? But see, his problem is that he's torn between these media archetypes of the old nature and the new nature. And at the same time, he's seen aspects of himself in every character in the cast. All right? All right, now what is the theme that Twin Peaks is going to freak people out with? It's become obvious that David Lynch is dealing on a perfect pitch sensitivity with the preoccupation of the latter 80s and into the 90s, the new age psychic obsession. Because if you think of it, more and more, most of the characters are involved with psychic activity in one way or another. Now, the psychic activity is obviously expressed in our show here with the Exus channeling through a person named Michael. See, that's what's interesting. The channel for the Exus, at certain points when I'm just talking to them, is a man named Michael. And so there's a psychic element in our show, and as Dave Bernard said at the staff meeting, he says, Bob, going to feature any predictions, at the fundraising next week. This psychic anticipatory effect of our theater we do here, our political campaign / theater, and or both sign, right? And the fact is that if you re-listen to the tapes, you can tell that Mike is putting stuff in his embeds, what we call the undertow, that can only be done psychically because he doesn't know what's going to be talked about, but he can juxtapose the items that fit with what's being talked about. I don't know how he does it, but this is the psychic level of this show. So this is why Twin Peaks is really talking to what we're doing here. Now, where do we go next with this? So the psychic theme is proven by the fact that, what, you've got Laura Palmer's mother is having psychic vision. She sees the past, all right, whereas her nephew or niece, Maddie, sees the future. She sees blood on the carpet and Bob coming in the room, right, the bad Bob.
How do you deal with the idea that that isn't Maddie, in fact, that is Laura? Laura is Maddie.
Oh, yeah, that's part of the that's necessary to show the metaphorical meaning of Laura in relation to all the aspects of mm-hmm. Agent Cooper, right? That's the, where are the women for this show? Where are the women in the Church of the Subgenius, Solar Government Headquarters, every second Wednesday here in Toronto? That's the question we're all wondering. Well, I'm going to get to that in a minute, but that's what that... See, Laura is there. Laura is there. She's not dead. All right? And James is he's singing away in the living room with the acoustic resonant echo, the electric Orion zone, and he doesn't know who his girlfriend is, right? Just you and I, right? Walking in the stars. So this psychic theme is pointed out also by the Log Lady. Who else is psychic? The Log Lady, there's Cooper himself. Cooper is developing his psychic abilities. And anybody else, maybe someone call in and remind us some other psychic things. But what's interesting is that Laura Palmer's father discounts, as far as we've seen so far, the psychic theme. He snubbed his wife when she was explaining what she saw to Cooper and Sheriff Truman. Now, when he comes in on the manipulators, the Horn brothers, wonderful characters, mm-hmm. right? Ben and Jer, right? And he comes in with this idea that they've got to call the Iceman and tell him about whatever it is.
The fire,
right? Yeah. The fire. See, the fire walk. And this is a problem for the visual space-bound guys, the Horn brothers, right? This fire problem is their dilemma, the electric environment. So... they are already on the phone. Leland Palmer's, Laura's father, doesn't think it's psychic. He calls it a coincidence. He can't believe that, from what he's seeing, that something accidental is, or something psychic that they picked up ahead of time what he was thinking about. Now, that's not what happened. See, these are the visual space guys. They cannot have psychic experiences. So Horn and them are cynical. The two Horn brothers are cynical and dismiss the concern of Leland about the coincidence. And it's not even a coincidence. I mean, it's just his own Leland Palmer's blindness about the situation that he thinks it's a coincidence. Now, juxtaposed with that is that you have the relationship between Andy and Lucy. You know, Mike, you know, Lucy, the secretary, the switchboard operator for Sheriff Truman, and her boyfriend, Andy. Now, if you notice that great scene where Andy's pacing back and forth, and Lucy is back in the room, and they've had a little tiff, so they're not speaking, and she's dealing with a buzzing fly. And so that's Andy walking about in front. And right when she swats the fly and knocks the pencils over, Andy makes a decision to come in and confront her. Now, see, what Lynch is doing there is he's showing us the synchronicity, the old 19th century version of psychic ability, psychic behavior, the synchronicity in life between two people. Now, they don't see it that way. It's only us, the viewer, that sees the synchronicity. So nobody points out it's a coincidence except the viewer. But we're echoed by our opposite, Leland Palmer, when he thinks he sees a coincidence and it's not a coincidence. It's just that they're one step ahead of him in their concerns over the firewalk, right? The Horn Brothers. So you see, there's a psychic theme. I just touch on those two points to illustrate. That's what Lynch is dealing with. And someone pointed out to me, I haven't seen Eraserhead in a long time, that Eraserhead opens up with a dream. I don't know if you remember that. Is that true? Now, you think, what's the difference between dreaming and psychic behavior? See, that's the question. Now, I talk about the collective psychic behavior, the complex clairvoyance between the media archetypes. This is something that the New Agers and the Aquarians have no concept yet of, but I know that's the reason why we can create this synchronicity on our show, because if I can know it, then it'll gravitate around us within the show, and these things happen that I do and you do. But back to Lynch, he's wrestling and mirroring the American biases concern for psychic behavior. Now, the question are the extraterrestrials a dream, or are they psychic, or are they really there? I think they're really there, but it's going to be hard for the citizens of Twin Peaks to take that, right? I mean, even Cooper went, oh my God, when he saw his name. Now, another big concern in the psychic world and the Aquarian world is the New Age world is UFOs. Now, there's a real funny joke here by David Lynch. You see, we've talked about Bill Cooper on the show. I don't know if you remember us talking about him?
Yeah.
He's a maniac running around exposing the MJ-12 cover-up, saying that George Bush and the Trilateral Commission, Kissinger and Rockefeller, have been dealing with aliens since like the 40s and abducting thousands of peoples, and secretly has been making deals with the aliens so that they could get technology from them and keeping it for themselves, the Trilaterals. Well, Hype magazine in its inaugural issue featured the Bill Cooper summons to George Bush to come to court. And this was in November 89. He summoned George Bush officially to come to court to deal with Bill Cooper's charges that George Bush and his cohorts have created a treasonous government cooperating with the alien nation. Okay, so you've got... This is Bill Cooper. All right, now, Mike, try to be patient with this. This isn't University of Toronto. This is not a funnel seminar. This is significant, I think, because the world is hanging on the abyss of a mythic collapse, and I think we need to have this explained, because I think David Lynch's program is being used at this point. All right? And I think it was used in the first series, but now they don't know how to use it, so they're going to discourage an audience. So Bill Cooper, and this is Hype magazine, Bob's spiritual advisor for it, they show the relevance of Cooper, and they put it on the cover of their inaugural issue, and you have the aliens communicating to Dale Cooper. So you have a satire on the UFO cult via the name Dale Cooper about the Bill Cooper phenomenon. He is stirring up a lot of problems. Pretty well about now he's been dismissed, but we played the Exus talking about Cooper about a month ago, maybe on the August 22nd show. See, this is the thing, what Lynch is talking about. I mean, maybe they were scripting this out on August 22nd, Lynch and them working this out, this Cooper element, while we're playing the real stuff here on the show. We had the real aliens, the Exus from the Booties, talking about Bill Cooper and showing how he was a fraud. So this is, you see the mirror? Do you see how it's hard to see not myself there? It's hard not to see you and me there, Mike, because look at the Mike and Bob dialectic. We know Mike, the one-armed shoe salesman. You know, he's the convert. He's trying to get back into the pink reality. He's fighting hard to do. He has to be a shoe salesman because he won't kill a game. Bob vowed he'd kill again, right? Now, you remember the mirror of that is little Bobby and Bobby Briggs and little Mike. Now, remember Mike? You remember that, those two little guys? You remember how Mike quit and we haven't seen him since? He got scared by Leo's dope deal? Okay, so Mike dropped out. Meanwhile, that mirrors the one-armed guy, Mike the Wizard, dropping out. The one who said on Jim's quote at the beginning that the magician longs to between to view the future past between two worlds. That's the interval. There's a bunch of other points here, Mike. Mike is really getting frustrated here with me. He thinks I'm going on too long. But I got a couple other points. I'm going to bring them up. I got to explain what the firewalking is, Mike. Now, here's a quick theme. The firewalk is seen in Cooper's first dream. Now, what's interesting, the phrase that's left at the murder site, fire, walk with me. Now, most symbolists know that the element of fire is the symbol for the electric environment. So fire, the electric environment, walk with me. Now, how do you walk on fire? Well, the electric environment is a tactile dance. So when you walk it, you look like that midget in Cooper's first dream. Remember he was doing his dance, but it was a walking dance? He was moving his torso, proprioceptive kinetic apparatus, and he was dancing with his torso but walking with his legs. Now, see, that's the message to Cooper about the firewalk. Now, firewalking is getting on the air with Bob, playing with Bob, being discarnate with Bob, and looking and experiencing the discarnate electric environment, the fire. Now, this comes back to Laura. Where is Laura? If you read Laura's diary, Laura is every night inhabited by Bob. And this points out that the majority of our listeners are women, Mike. But they're like Laura. It's a fantasy zone. And it seems like we've killed the women. But no, because Bob's a woman. And what are the Bobs? You've got the bad Bob. And then you've got the good Bob. Now, the good Bob, what is the good Bob? I'd say it's Cooper. Okay, what would you say the good Bob is? Then you got the bad Bob. The good Bob is the alien, maybe. Just start off at that point, okay? But what is the real Bob, B-O-B, beware of Bob, is the electric situation, the dance of the electric fire itself. That's me. That's the merged Bob. That's what this thing is trying to address. This is what Twin Peaks is dealing with. Okay, there's more to say, but let's take, we had a call, or did they fade out?
Well, they've been fading out because they've been talking for so long, right?
Okay, I got some more to say unless you want to interrupt. Do you have anything to say what I'm saying?
We've got a call now.
Okay,
call.
Let them come in.
Yeah, I'd like to let people
What time
in.
Is it? How long did I go?
It's 10 minutes to 1 o'clock.
Oh, my.
You went for 25 minutes.
Oh, sorry.
You're listening to The Church of the Subgenius, and we will go to the phones. You've got to turn your volume down a little bit. That's why you're getting feedback as well. Hello? Hi? You're on the air?
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, good. I'm on the air. Right, I just wanted to point out a couple of things. On some level, the pinks at ABC must know that there is this message embedded into the whole thing of Twin Peaks. Otherwise, they wouldn't have put the show on at 10 o'clock on a Saturday night to reach less of an audience, because who's going to stay home on Saturday night? Who has got the energy to to just sit at home and say, I'm going to cancel Saturday night and sit and watch Twin Peaks, unless they're tied into the electronics and videotape everything, but, you know, as most fanatics will do. But in any case, the point being that all of the hype that's happened after the first season has made is kind of making the message reach a wider audience through, again, the insinuation of all the various media forms. And I think someone picked up on that. Otherwise, they wouldn't have really put it into dead air time, which is Saturday night. I don't think you could ever think of a show that existed on Saturday night that survived. So I think that really this is it. I mean, if Lynch has got a message to say, or if he's being used, he's going to have to do it soon, because if this survives by Christmas, I'll be quite surprised. And really, I think the point that I'm trying to make is somebody knows that, and that's why it got stuck on where it did get stuck on.
Well, you're 122% correct. There is a conspiracy, because They're talking, Lynch is talking about the discarnate state, and your metaphor of putting it on dead air is the point. You cannot have that show being as effective as it was in the first series when everybody's watching it live and feeling it live. Now, the fanatics will tape it, but that's not the same as sharing it live on the air when it's happening, the psychic interplay and the collective consciousness,
right? Well, of course not, because everybody's doing it at the same time, and there's that whole body of energy that's connecting with that particular experience.
Right, and is that true, that if you put a show on Saturday night, it's a way of killing it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've watched plenty of TV in my time, and I can't remember a successful show on it Saturday night. I do remember that when they decided to kill Star Trek, they stuck it on at 10 o'clock Friday night. And everybody knew in the cast that when it got stuck on that slot, that they were doomed.
So I think LaRouche, David Lynch, I've got this little LaRouche poster here, the owls, and they're not what they seem. The owls. And the owls are also the Elohim in the Bible and in occult lore. The elves are the creators of the universe. But caller, this point, Lynch, I think he was genuinely surprised at the success of the show, because this show was a project that he was seriously creating, and he had his agenda, and it's going to be carried out. I think the agenda will be completed at the end of this series, and we won't need to do it. It'll be a tableau of two series, right?
Well, I certainly hope so. Otherwise, we're going to be seeing more obsession commercials directed by Lynch, right?
Yeah.
You know, which are kind of depressing on one hand.
That's right. Now, the thing is, this is really relevant that you're talking about. They got to kill the live discarnate effect, and that's the significance of every media form miming what goes on here at CKLN and why we should be supported in a public level.